Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Thank you to Scamfluencers and Cash App for sponsoring this episode.
What Came Next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening.
Janelle Hill is a psychiatric nurse practitioner and survivor from Montana. She and I first had the chance to meet each other at an intimate dinner celebrating the survivor-founded nonprofit, the Army of Survivors, and their newest evolution, a full rebranding as the Athlete Survivors Assist. Janelle currently proudly serves on their advisory board and shared a bit of her story that evening I met her. I was deeply moved by her strength, expertise, and ability to encapsulate her difficult experiences with grace and relatability. The Broken Cycle Media team is very grateful Janelle took the time to share her story of survivorship and about her advocacy work with our audience in the following two episodes.
My name is Janelle Hill. I am a mom. I'm also a psychiatric nurse practitioner. I have owned my own practice since 2016. Prior to that, I worked inpatient psych for 5 or 6 years. But that just feels like such a small part of who I am. My career doesn't define me. I feel like who I truly am is an advocate and the voice of those who have experienced abuse. That's what drives me. That's what I do in my free time. That's what I talk about any chance that I get. Being an example of a survivor in my everyday life and even in the way that I parent my kids, teaching them to stand up for what's right, stand up for those who are struggling, I think that more embodies who I am as a person. I also sit on the executive board for the Army of Survivors, which coincidentally, we actually are changing our name as of November 19th to the Athlete Assist to just better encompass our mission and be more easily accessible to athletes. What we do on a daily basis is help assist athlete survivors through the healing process. I grew up in Kalispell, Montana. We were 30 minutes out of town in the mountains. If you've ever been to Montana, the most gorgeous place that, of course, you don't really fully appreciate as a young person until you grow up and leave. I have 3 siblings above me and 2 beneath me. We grew up as close as 6 siblings can be in 1 tiny little house. I really enjoyed a large family and always felt very grateful for the family that I grew up in. We grew up in a very small house, majority of my upbringing. We lived on our neighbor's property and we had horses. It almost felt magical. The time that we spent together as siblings has always been something that I looked back on and wanted to replicate in my adult life. But it's hard to connect with how I used to feel about it just because that has changed. I was homeschooled my entire life. I actually really enjoyed it. I started college classes when I was about 16 years old. So I just liked the freedom of being able to move ahead. We definitely all had our various chores, especially when we were really young. We would have days where we would help out in the community garden. And I really enjoyed that as a child. I started working at a really young age to help provide for my own needs, clothing and shoes and things like that, which was also something that I always really enjoyed. We had a really close homeschool athletic community. We were very connected to that. We all played several sports. We did piano, we did choir, church youth group. So we felt very involved, but it was a very conservative community. The religious upbringing that we were under was very much cult-like in nature. The father or the head of the household was the end-all, be-all. The wife definitely took a back seat. There was, especially within our household, a very controlling and manipulative aspect to our faith, just an extreme fear that I wasn't good enough. Something that my father ingrained in that process was, if you don't please him, then you can never please God. And if he was angry at you, then that meant God was angry at you. So there was this constant feeling of walking on eggshells. I felt this huge sense of obligation to be the emotional support to my father. I could see what a dysfunctional and hurting human that he was, and constantly felt the need to write him encouraging notes and make sure that he felt loved and make sure that he felt seen, and tried to be the go-between and the in-between in his relationship with my mom to help assure him that he was appreciated, assure her that she was loved. So those parentification aspects, it did not feel like my emotional needs were the priority.
Around what age do you remember taking on these roles?
Probably around middle school. That sense really continued through high school. There was days when my dad would tell me that he wished that I was his wife, which created a lot of conflicting feelings. Obviously shame and disgust, but also feeling that I was betraying my mom, that he was saying those things to me. So psychologically, just a very challenging environment. I would say there was always an unpredictable expectation. One time I remember we had gotten macaroons from Costco. I think maybe we tried to eat one without asking, and he just became super angry and threw the whole thing in the trash. That's just such a small example, but there was this constant feeling of, I can't show anger or excitement because any emotion that I show will be used against me. If there was something that was really exciting or something that I was looking forward to, I would act completely neutral about it, because I knew if he could tell that I wanted something, then he would withhold it from me. A lot of the turmoil emotionally would come from me wanting to do things with my friends or have some type of opportunity with our peers. There was a time when we were hanging out in the mall with some teammates, and one of our teammates said, "Is that your dad hiding behind that bush over there?" He was monitoring us from a distance. We would go to Dairy Queen, hanging out with our friends, and he would be circling the Dairy Queen building constantly. He seemed to really enjoy inflicting emotional turmoil. There's times that I recall him forcing me to stare at myself in the mirror while I was crying, and just told me I was the most beautiful when I was crying. Any conversation wouldn't really resolve itself or even let up until you reached a really emotional state. And then he could console you then and would switch his tune a little bit. I couldn't really even describe to you the range of emotions that we were trying to predict, but I would say rage would be absolutely the number one, and it was 100% unpredictable when that would occur.
Thank you again to Scamfluencers for sponsoring this episode. Scams are everywhere. On your phone, in your inbox, even on your television screen. I'm looking at you, Tinder Swindler. What is it about scams that has pop culture so obsessed? Maybe it's because it can happen to anyone. Or maybe it's because we're all deeply fascinated by the psyche of someone who can lie with ease, cheat with no guilt, and convince the world they are who they say they are, even when they're not. Scamfluencers is a weekly podcast that takes you into the world of deception, sharing the stories of today's most notorious scams, like the recent episode of Natalie Cochran, the pharmacist femme fatale. It seemed like she had it all, a good job, loving husband, and two kids. But behind the scenes, Natalie was scamming friends and family using fake contracts, fake government emails. She even faked cancer. But when the walls start closing in, she'll do anything to keep the lie alive until someone ends up dead. Listen to Scamfluencers now, wherever you get your podcasts.
My sisters dated. I never thought it was worth the trouble. I had crushes on people, but I did not want to date. And I remember one individual from my youth group called my house one day. When I answered, I said, "Don't ever call my house," because I really didn't want the scrutiny and the attention on me. We were really good kids. As they say, the fear of God was in us. We did nothing out of the ordinary, but it was that environment where you feel like even if you're doing everything right, there's still something that you're going to get in trouble for, or something that you've done wrong. I remember journaling. I wanted to write how I was actually feeling, but I felt like I had to write this very picture-perfect script of how grateful I was and how wonderful everything was. I didn't feel like there was any place that felt safe to express my true thoughts. That led to severe depression and suicidal ideation, really for as long as I could remember. I just had no capability to tolerate the extreme emotional pain that I felt. I developed a technique within myself to be able to, if I felt emotional or physical pain, to be able to visualize it leaving my body. And I would shake as the pain was leaving my body and then have a total dissociative experience and not be able to feel pain. I had a difficult time recognizing myself in the mirror. I know now as a psych provider that those were all symptoms of dissociative disorder and severe trauma. But at the time, it just felt like evidence of my defectiveness and my sin and all the ways that I was so imperfect and so unlovable. When I was feeling really upset, I would get hives up my neck. And that just felt torturous to me because I didn't want anyone to be able to see that I was experiencing an emotion. And those aspects of my upbringing have had a lasting effect because I see even in my everyday life as an adult and even as a clinician that when I'm consoling people dealing with grief and loss, that it is very difficult for me to bring any emotion to my face. I can verbalize that I am with them and that I'm empathetic, but there's very little emotional connection that I'm actually feeling in my body. And I think that creates a challenge as a friend, a parent, and a professional.
Thank you for sharing that. It just speaks to the depth with which trauma affects us. You sought solace in sports. What did you receive from that?
I played basketball and volleyball, and that was something that I absolutely loved. I did really well. I was typically one of the captains. I won MVP. We did really well in terms of state tournaments. We were undefeated for 3 years in a row in high school. So basketball and volleyball were absolutely my life. I always wanted to play college ball, and I would spend hours outside shooting or practicing volleyball to try and make up for those who were naturally athletic, because I more had the work ethic than the natural abilities. I dealt with a lot of anger within sports, so I would get flagrant fouls and would smack my hands on the floor so hard that I would have deep purple bruises in my hands. I just had a really difficult time accepting failure when I wasn't playing the best. It just outraged me. And I remember my coach telling me he thought I needed anger management. When I look back, I realize the level of anger that I was expressing through sports was so incongruent to the situation, but it was because it was completely related to my home environment. I always wanted to play college ball. I really wanted to go to school to be a brain surgeon initially. I've always been fascinated with the brain. It wasn't until I got to school that I realized I enjoyed my patients talking, so maybe I wouldn't want to be a surgeon. So I went to nursing school at our community college, which was a good nursing school, and I would have done well to continue that. But I was contacted by a coach in Eastern Montana, and he offered me a scholarship for basketball and volleyball. So I dropped out of that nursing program and moved to Eastern Montana, which is about 12 hours away, to play basketball and volleyball. That experience was really challenging. I think coming from an environment where you have experienced so much control and trauma and been so enmeshed in that space, that being away from home for the first time and watching, I guess, those aspects of myself unfold and the dysfunctional coping mechanisms that I had created, when you're not within the walls of your home, it can feel really jarring, and you can start to feel completely isolated from your peers, especially those who seem to have a really carefree view of the world. I always felt like I couldn't connect to anyone around me. And I was always the person that people confided in with their true emotions. And I think that's because they could feel that I was emotionally available for them, but never really felt like I was able to create a deep connection for myself. I got into a relationship with an individual that was traumatized himself. Being in a relationship continued to bring up these aspects of myself that I really could not find a route to because I was so dissociated from what my life had actually been. Whenever we got into an argument, I would completely shut down and literally be unable to speak words. That makes it very difficult to be in a healthy relationship with someone. And through those years, that's when I was introduced to my coach that later assaulted me. For 3 years, I really viewed him as a mentor and someone that was helping guide me through my adult life. And I had confided in him about my dysfunctional relationship and about my family. Now, looking back, I can recall times where he was really verbally aggressive towards me, put me down and challenged my feelings and made me feel very small and stupid. But I really didn't see that. I think I was so far into that relationship dynamic that I really just took that on as truth, because I truly believed that he had my best interests at heart. I had transferred to a 4-year university at that point, and I was actually on my way home for summer break. I was passing through Montana on my way home. My parents and my sister were with me. I had just made the decision to break up with my boyfriend. I was supposed to be going to see him on the way home. So I had reached out to my coach and told him that we were breaking up, how difficult it was. And he had said that he was actually in that town that I was in that night, which was several hours away from where I thought he was. He asked if I wanted to come out and talk to him. He was going to come to the hotel to speak with me. I genuinely didn't think twice about it. Like I said, this person was someone that I really respected for years. But from the moment that I got in the car, I could feel that something was off. He appeared to be under the influence and was extremely demeaning, assaulting my character and calling me stupid for ever being with him, which was a shock to me because he had been the one initially who had recommended that I stay at the school and try and work the relationship out. He went from being verbally abusive to physically abusive. It completely took me off guard. It was one of the most shocking moments of my life. I think it's easy being on this side of it and easy for people outside of a sexual assault situation to ask, why didn't you punch him in the face and run away? But especially when you've experienced sexual trauma prior, especially when you have not processed that or even acknowledged that it existed in your life prior, those coping mechanisms kick in instantaneously. And I said multiple times that I did not want him to do that. He challenged me that I didn't know what I wanted and was choking me at the time. During the sexual assault, I just recall being completely outside the car, hovering above my body, totally disconnected from what was happening to me. What really lingered in my mind after that assault was when I was leaving the vehicle, he had said that he knew I wasn't stupid enough to put this on Facebook, to report it, or tell anyone about it, because he was coaching an 8th grade volleyball team and he wanted to make sure that all of those girls continued to trust him. And that really ignited a fire in me, even in that moment. He blatantly knew that he had done something wrong because he didn't want me to speak up about it. I walked back into the hotel and I just remember my biggest concern was, what if my dad saw that? And what if he's mad at me? And what if he doesn't believe me or thinks that I wanted that? So back in the hotel, I was sitting in the bathroom and trying not to cry because I didn't want my parents to hear me. And then just going to bed like nothing happened. It was just an excruciatingly painful experience. The next day when I was reflecting back on the situation, I remember noticing that that wasn't the first time that I had felt that way or the first time that I'd experienced looking at myself from such a far distance.
Thank you again to Cash App for sponsoring this episode. As someone who used to use the same banking system since I babysat in my teen years, I used to catch myself wondering what more my banking loyalty could do for me. Then I found how simple and secure Cash App is. Cash App just released a new status program for the way people actually spend called Cash App Green. It unlocks new ways for you to pay, get rewarded, and easily grow or manage your money on your terms. Now, when you spend at least $500 a month with the Cash App card or Cash App Pay, you earn green status, which unlocks benefits like up to $200 of free overdraft coverage, higher borrow limits, and custom personalized cashback offers every Friday at places you love to shop. Turn everyday spending into status with Cash App Green. Download Cash App today or visit cash.app/new to learn more about this and other great features launching now. And for a limited time, new Cash App customers can earn $10 if they use the code CASHAPP10 in their profile at signup and send $5 to a friend within 14 days. That's code CASHAPP10. Terms apply. Cash App is a financial services platform, not a bank. Banking services provided by Cash App's bank partners. Prepaid debit cards issued by Sutton Bank, member FDIC. Cash App Green, overdraft coverage, borrow, cashback offers, and promotions provided by Cash App, a Block, Inc. brand. Visit cash.app/legal/podcast for full disclosures.
It took me probably a week or two before I finally went and spoke with my youth pastor. He had strongly encouraged that I call the police. That was not something that I really even knew if I was ready to do, but I'm glad that he encouraged me to do that. After I spoke with the police on the phone, They said that they really wanted my parents involved. They recommended that I tell them. And that was the most horrifying moment for me. There was literally no part of me that wanted my parents to be involved in that situation. But they said it was necessary if it were to proceed. So I did tell my parents before the first interview with the police. And that experience was really hurtful. I sat them both down in the living room. I really didn't know how to even start that conversation. But I did say my coach sexually assaulted me. They act shocked. And then I said that I'd gone to the police. My mom just shook her head and said, why would I do something like that? That was going to be way too much trouble. I remember looking over at my dad and he was clapping his hands and laughing hysterically. That was just a very confusing moment for me. If anything, I was a little bit relieved that he wasn't completely furious with me. I felt very confused. Was it even that big of a deal? I definitely couldn't quite grasp my own feelings after that reaction. I just remember walking into the police station to meet with a detective by myself. I was just sitting on this chair in the middle of a room waiting while a dozen people walked by these windows. You feel scared and out of place. I felt like no one was taking me seriously. Whether that was true or not, that's how it felt. The detective nonchalantly walked in, leaned against the wall, asked me a few questions, asked what I was wearing. It was such a short interview. I had told them, this is the hotel where it happened. The car was parked right outside of the main entrance. Can you please contact the hotel and get the security footage? We were so close to the front of the hotel, I would not be surprised if it was all caught on footage through the windshield, but they never did that. I know that they did bring him in for questioning, and of course, he denied it. Once he was brought in for questioning, he reached out to all of my former teammates and my former coach that I've been extremely close to. He told them that I had just broke up with my boyfriend and he thought I was having a psychiatric break. After reporting that to the police and really feeling extremely vulnerable, then having to turn around and try and explain myself to multiple people who all knew him as well. They just had a really hard time believing that that was true. Everyone loved that coach. He was a fun person to be around. So those conversations just really fell flat. They didn't believe me. They asked their questions and then they just never responded again. And I think that that was also hard to just feel like he was taking my whole system from me. There was a morning when I felt really overwhelmed and upset by the whole situation. I was cooking my eggs and I remember my dad walking up behind me. He noticed that I was crying and he said, "What are you crying about?" And I told him that I talked to the detective and I was frustrated with the process. He just scoffed and said, "Why on earth would you let something so small ruin your day?" As a young adult who's truly trying to do right and find your worth, I think that that time period was really damaging and really difficult for me because I truly felt like I was doing the right thing by speaking up, and all the messaging that I was receiving back was that I was overreacting. Looking back on that time in my life, I just realized that no one was trauma-informed. No one knew how to handle a situation like that appropriately.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
Through that whole summer, I obsessively worked out at the gym for 6 to 8 hours a day. I felt so much anxiety in my arms. It felt like my body was so overly tense that I couldn't control my muscle movements. So when I came back to school at the end of the summer, it was an extremely frustrating year. It wasn't until August that two detectives contacted me. I remember I was standing in my dorm room when they called. I think everything shifted from that moment. There was a crack in the shield, as it were. I started to experience a lot of flashbacks from my childhood.
Thank you again to Scamfluencers and Cash App for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget to listen to Scamfluencers now wherever you get your podcasts. And download Cash App today or visit cash.app/new to learn more about other great features Cash App is launching now. And for a limited time, don't forget, new Cash App customers can earn $10 if they use the code CASHAPP10 in their profile at sign up and send $5 to a friend within 14 days.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production, co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.